So Boris asked me to talk to this group, and it looks like a pretty diverse group. And we started out by me saying to Boris something along the lines of, would it be interesting for the physicists in our program to hear something about how we think or attack experimental problems? And he said, well, I've got a great idea. And then Boris cooked up the title. So at least it started out as how do biologists think. At least I got him to say molecular biologists. I think the distinctive thing about the way a lot of molecular biology, I'm curious to know how the rest of you think your field is different, but one component of molecular biology that's always struck me is that there's a lot of binary logic in the way we attack experimental problems, and I'll give you plenty of examples of that. That is to say, we can very often phrase the questions in such a way as to have a yes, no, or this or that kind of answer. As we move, starting from molecular biology in through biochemistry and off toward chemistry, and I've sort of, in my career, gone over that range. As we get closer to chemistry, the issues, that way of thinking becomes less and less useful. And I gather from what Boris says that physicists find it of no use at all, and you're just always measuring numbers. I'm not sure I understood that correctly, but that's what I understood him to say. So what I thought I would do, instead of, I'm not a philosopher in any sense of the world, in any sense of the word, so I thought what I'd do is really just talk about the subject matter of molecular biology, first talking about sort of the basics of it so that physicists will at least know.
Sometimes too many people, probably.
That's all right. Okay. So one of the important branches of molecular biology is what we call information transfer. Cell has a way of transferring the information it needs from a sort of central repository called DNA to making molecules that the cell needs to carry out its various functions. I don't know how much I need to go over the real basics of this. If I'm going too slow, please say so. If I'm going too fast, ask a question. So the kind of information cells mostly need is particular composition of proteins. Proteins are really important constituents of the cell. A lot of them are enzymes that carry out very specific biochemical reactions that the cell needs for one reason or another. Others do things like hemoglobin, you're all familiar with, carry oxygen from our lungs to our tissues. And so the overall process of expressing these proteins, this kind of information that the cell needs, takes place in several stages. And I want to describe briefly what those stages are. So if we start out with a DNA molecule, I think I need to describe DNA a little bit, do I? How many people? I don't. Okay, good. Okay, we start out with a DNA molecule, has a particular sequence of bases. And the distinctive feature of DNA is that each of those bases, or each of these bits of information, is present in a redundant form because it's present on both strands, and wherever you find a G on this strand, there's a C on this strand, and so on. This DNA is transcribed in a process that I'll describe in more detail into a kind of molecule called messenger RNA. It's typically just a copy of one of the strands of the DNA. And then that RNA molecule is translated to particular proteins. And what's specified in the DNA sequence is the amino acid sequence of a protein. A protein is a linear polymer that has 20 different kinds of building blocks called amino acids. And since there's 20 kinds, the DNA has to be read in groups of at least three at a time. And so the genetic code simply relates the particular sequence of these three to a particular amino acid that winds up in the polypeptide. So if we have a group of 300 nucleotides in the DNA, we wind up down here with a protein of defined sequence that has 100 amino acids in it.
What's special about three?
Well, it could be more, but it can't be less. If it was only two, then there's, I'm sorry, there's four possibilities for the choice of base. And so the number of different groups that you can have, it goes by 2 to the n. So if you have only, I mean, you could say, let's, well, okay, sorry. So if you could say, well, let's just make do with 16 amino acids, and we'll have groups of two, but that's not the way it comes to us in nature. There's 20 amino acids, I have no idea, maybe somebody does, why these particular 20 were chosen or why there wouldn't be 25 or 30. But this is what we find in any case, that there are 20 common amino acids.
They, is there any overlap with that?
Sorry?
Is there any overlap between successive groups? So for instance, you know, you could have AAT for one group and then TCG for the other. That never happens.
That's not, well, in very rare cases it happens. In very rare cases, you can have a gene, I'm sorry, these blocks of groups starting from the beginning of the protein to the end is what we call a gene. And in some few cases, you can have overlapping genes like that. And so in here, the information is a lot more restricted because it has to serve two different purposes. Any other questions about that? So we have a simple pathway of information flow. And a lot of what molecular biology is concerned with is how this pathway is regulated. So I'm going to change the scale of this a bit, have this be a large DNA. And we'll say this distance here is 300 base pairs. That would code for a rather small protein of 100 amino acids. Most proteins are larger than that. To do this process of gene expression, there are many opportunities for regulation. The first thing to recognize is if this little block here carries the actual information for the protein, typically there's a start signal, which I'll just call P for reasons I'll say in a minute, that tells a particular enzyme where to start, another stop signal called T for terminator that tells it where to stop. And so there's a machinery that's much more complicated in our cells than it is in bacteria that recognizes where to start and where to stop. In bacteria, which I'll mostly be talking about, this sequence is a relatively simple, well-defined thing. It's called a promoter, and an enzyme, a particular enzyme, binds there, initiates transcription, this process of making the message, and it terminates at a particular stop signal. So that makes a messenger RNA of a certain size. This then goes to a protein factory called a ribosome, which takes the information here and translates it into the amino acid sequence in the protein. There are many opportunities in this scheme for gene regulation. Gene regulation is a lot, I'd say it's most of what the BioNetworks program is about. The first opportunity is a decision whether or not to transcribe this gene. And there's many ways that decision can be made. And we'll talk about some of those in a bit. So there are decisions about whether or not to start here. There are occasionally decisions about whether to stop somewhere in the middle or to stop very early on the process of transcription, but those are relatively rare and I won't dwell on those. So the process of initiating transcription here is a very common way this process is controlled. There's one step I've left out here, which is much more prevalent in our cells than in bacteria, and that is an extensive process, bit of RNA, the initial message, being processed into a mature form. And so that's another opportunity for regulation, because this processing can be made to work or not. It can be made to work in a lot of different patterns. Finally, the step of translation of this message in the protein is susceptible to regulation as well, and there are numerous examples in which that's the case. In addition, the mRNA can be degraded, so it has a particular stability, and that stability can be regulated. Similarly, the protein can be degraded, and its stability can be regulated as well. And so, as I said, that if the overall goal is to have a particular level of the protein, a particular protein in the cell, there's many different ways that that level of protein can be modulated.
What do you mean by who regulates what?
Well, I'll give you a good example of that. I think it'll be clearer after I give the example. But it's an excellent question. That's sort of what we're going to talk about the rest of the time. Other questions? Well, let's just mention that very briefly now. I'll just give you a simple example of how a particular gene can be regulated. So, as I said, well, I didn't really say, but there's an enzyme called RNA polymerase. That's the enzyme that binds to the start point of transcription and recognizes this particular site and causes the gene to be transcribed. I think it's probably worth saying here, if people don't know it, that very many regulatory proteins have the property of being what we call specific DNA binding proteins. They bind very specifically to a very small number of sites on the DNA. Typically in a cell it might be between 1 and 100 sites out of, in bacteria, 10 million or so possible sites. And so these specific DNA binding proteins have a lot of specificity. This one can bind to a few thousand places, and so its specificity is more complicated than most proteins. So as for regulation, let's imagine that the site for this enzyme is there, and we'll imagine that we have another site for a different DNA binding protein that partly overlaps this one. Okay? So if the binding site for this other protein overlaps this one, it's not very likely that both of them can bind at the same time. So if we have this other protein bound to its specific site here, then this gene can't be turned on. Okay? So that's a very simple example of regulation. This would be acting as what we call a repressor. And then the other thing you need, and I think this is what your question was getting to, is how do you control it? How do you regulate whether or not this repressor binds here? Very commonly, that regulation takes place by conformational changes in the protein, and I'll just symbolize this very schematically to say that if the protein has some compound bound to it, is this blue chalk visible? If this protein has some compound bound to it, it changes its shape in such a way that now it's capable of binding to the DNA. So it only binds in the presence of this compound. So then in this kind of example then, if this compound is present in the environment, then this protein will change its shape, it'll bind to its site and shut this gene off. Okay. There's many different ways of changing the activities of regulatory proteins, and we'll talk about several of them, but just to give you a little bit of an idea, one way is by some kind of reversible, these kind of changes are always reversible, what's called an allosteric change, where you change the structure of the protein by binding some ligand. Another common way is to have some kind of covalent modification of the protein. Phosphorylation is a very common kind where one of the amino acid side chains would be phosphorylated. Another very common way is to regulate, and this is pushing the problem back one step really, is to regulate whether or not this regulatory protein is present in the cell at all or not. If it's not there, then it can't do its job. So it's just pushing the regulatory problem back a step, but it's a very common design.
You're going to put in an activator.
Sorry?
You've got a repressor. What about activator?
Oh, well, I'll talk about, okay, well, so let's list a little bit more the kinds of regulatory proteins we have. So this one acts as a repressor. It shuts things off. Another very common kind, if this is the gene again, is to have something that changes its shape again when you add some kind of ligand, and it binds here. But now it has a different kind of effect. It activates or stimulates the transcription of this gene. And this is the opposite kind of behavior in a lot of ways. The idea in this particular case is this is in bacteria would be a terrible promoter. Just the RNA polymerase wouldn't be able to bind there. But in some way that we don't need to specify, the activator would work to make this a much more strong promoter. It would increase the affinity of the polymerase for this site is one common way. Okay, so these are kinds of building blocks that we can have to build up regulatory networks.
But then somebody would have to regulate I as well, right?
Well, so
worry where would it all end?
Okay, so I'm going to talk mostly about bacteria, and I'll say why in a minute.
Okay.
So I would be in this way of thinking something that's present in the environment of the bacteria. The bacteria are single-celled organisms. They're not complex like we are with lots of different kinds of tissues. So their way of living is mostly to respond to the environment in ways that are mostly reversible, so that if they find a situation where, let's say, there's some kind of sugar that's not that common and they'd like to be able to break it down so they can use it for food, then the presence of that sugar, if it can get into the cell at all, will cause some gene to be made that'll break it down. So when we think about this, we think of it as some small molecule that comes in from the environment. It doesn't have to work that way, and you could have, and there are certainly examples of small molecules that are made inside the cell. But they're in generally responding to something in the environment as well, in a more indirect kind of way. Okay? So before I tell you about a particular regulatory system that we've worked on for a long time, I thought it might be worth, and I think some contribution from Lewis and other people might be helpful here too, is to talk a little bit about what biologists call model organisms. And maybe I don't need to persuade you of the usefulness of having a model organism. The basic idea is that we've chosen a relatively restricted number of different organisms to study and analyze in a lot of detail. And you might think that's a risky business because it might mean we'd miss something important. And certainly there are enough mavericks in the field, I guess you'd expect that, that people don't all stick to the same model organisms. And certainly studying things that seem out off the beaten path has been fruitful in many occasions. Nonetheless, it's a useful way to proceed because it means if I do an experiment and Boris does an experiment, we have at least a fighting chance of comparing our findings and to relate them to a much larger body of knowledge about that particular organism. So you guys might not agree what makes a good model organism. That's I think model organisms are certainly useful in making progress. I don't know if I could get agreement amongst 10 biologists what would make a good model organism, but I'll tell you what I think. One is, and this would apply more to something like fruit flies or Drosophila, that it would have interesting behavior. Because then you have something that you feel like is worth studying. It really depends for this particular one what kinds of issues you're trying to deal with. And a lot of what Drosophila is dealing with the studies on Drosophila, a lot of it has to do with issues of how the organism comes to be the way it is, a process called development that Lewis is...
I'm sure I would know what an organism is that doesn't show any interesting behavior.
Okay. Well, maybe that's a bad example then.
Maybe.
Okay.
It's everything's interesting.
Let's start over. Okay, so I'll just give you my list. I was trying to keep Lewis in the...
No, we love to fly.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, we all basically fly. I mean, I always claim that the Drosophila were discussing human development. They'd say, gosh, aren't they like us?
In some ways. Okay.
Representative.
I think one reason for picking a model organism is that it's easy to work with. And there's two different ways that that I work with model organisms, and other people, a lot of other people do too. One is that it has the ability to do what we call genetics, and I'll describe what that means in a second. Another is that it allows us to do biochemistry. And if you can do both of these things, then it allows you to get a very productive kind of interplay between these two approaches in a way that I'll describe after I tell you about what I mean by these two things. You want to add anything to this list? Or?
Boss.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. So, yeah. Well, okay. So that sort of goes under easy to work with. But so. No, I didn't put that up here. So fast and.
And easy to work.
Yeah, cheap, easy to grow. Yeah, hopefully an invertebrate. Okay, so there are a lot of other practical traits like this that make one choose an organism in preference to another one. I think another one is easy to grow, is easy to reproduce your experiments, so that if I do an experiment and Boris does an experiment and Kim does an experiment, we're all reasonably confident if we did the same experiment, we'd get the same result. Sure.
So you said that the replication occurs through molecules binding to the DNA, right?
The transcription, this process, yes.
Now, how do you know that happens experimentally? Because you have, say, one piece of DNA in a cell. So how do people see that? Do they actually see it, or indirect argument?
That's where, people are starting to see it now. That's where this process comes in a lot of ways. It's hard to see it in the cell, but it's possible to study it in the test tube once you've got your purified components. And I'll talk a little bit about that if you're interested. Let me.
Isn't the chemistry much more complicated, because presumably the reaction would differ depending on what the surroundings are?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, so let's just take that as an example of biochemistry. So to do the biochemistry of that process, you'd need several things. One is, and I'll just mention where these come from after I say what they are. One is you need a specific piece of DNA that you're interested in, something that's whose properties you'd like to analyze a bit more. And nowadays, that DNA is always acquired by recombinant DNA methodology, or by a process called PCR that I don't want to take the time to describe. Anyway, it's possible to get the piece of DNA relatively easily. Another thing you need is the enzyme, which I'll very simply schematize. It has several subunits called RNA polymerase. And there's two different ways to get the RNA polymerase. One is to grow a lot of cells and use an elaborate purification procedure to isolate it from everything else in the cell. The other is you buy it from a company who's already had someone do that for you. And that's a common approach these days. Then you need some kind of buffer and some salts that the polymerase requires and some substrates for its reaction, which would be the four nucleotide bases that are broken down to make this reaction. Okay, so if you have all of these, and you add the RNA polymerase to your DNA, in principle, it would start at a particular place and run off the end, and then you could analyze this by a method called gel electrophoresis. I'm not sure I'm answering your question. So how do we know the polymerase binds here, for example? Let's start with that. So there are methods for detecting protein binding to particular sites. I could describe them, but I'm not sure that it's worth the trouble for this audience. One is called a DNase-1 footprinting. It gives you a map to within a couple of nucleotides where the protein is bound, because it protects the DNA when it's bound there from attack by agents that otherwise would break the DNA. So it's possible to tell where it binds. It's possible to tell how tightly it binds, how fast it goes on, how fast it comes off. And like you say, all those things are very dependent on the conditions. Typically, people do these reactions in a relatively low salt concentration. If you raise the salt concentration, most DNA binding proteins don't bind as tightly. Okay. So this is an example of what I'm talking about when I say biochemistry, that it's in a good model organism, it's easy to do this kind of analysis. And this is just one simple example of it. If I were to add an activator to this system or a repressor, I would find, hopefully, that their behavior was what I expected to find based on the genetics behavior. So I need to tell you what genetics is. So again, I may find some disagreement with definitions, but basically genetics is a set of tools and approaches, it's a way of thinking in a lot of ways, of isolating variant organisms from your population that have an altered behavior in some way. So for example, if the gene I'm regulating is one that allows the cell to grow on a particular kind of sugar, if I got a mutant that couldn't grow in that sugar, let's just say, okay, I guess I need to define what mutants are, actually. So we have a sequence of bases in the DNA. If those change, in general, if one of them changes, in general, you'll make a change in the amino acid sequence of the protein target, the protein that's coded for by this gene. Some of those changes are going to be innocuous, but a lot of them will affect the function of the protein. Some of them will completely destroy the function of the protein by making it inactive or unstable, or make the translation process stop in the middle. And so very many changes in the DNA will cause a difference in the functioning of the protein that's made by this process.
So how do you get a mutant?
Well, there's a million different ways. And that's sort of the art of genetics, is isolating mutants and recognizing their behavior. But I'll give you an example. Let's suppose that the cell, like E. coli, the organism I work on, can grow on a sugar called lactose that is present in milk. It does that by making an enzyme, two enzymes actually, one called beta-galactosidase, which we always call beta-gal. I'll tell you what it does in a minute, and another protein called lac-permease. So the lac-permease pumps the lactose into the cell in an active kind of way. The beta-galactosidase, lactose has a structure of galactose glucose, and the beta-galactosidase breaks those into these two components so that they can then enter into the metabolism of the cell. Okay, so the cell has the capability of taking this external agent and utilizing it to grow on. So now let's imagine that we're not starting at the very beginning, but that we're, at least we've talked to our microbiology colleagues, and they say, okay, if you have an organism, people know what petri dishes are? Okay. If you have an organism that can metabolize lactose, we'll say that on this particular kind of plate, it makes a red colony. And now we'll say, if it doesn't, can't metabolize lactose, it'll make a white colony. So your ordinary wild type, if you put 1,000 cells on here, each one grows into a colony, and they'll all be red. But if there's an occasional mutant that can't break down the lactose, then it'll make a white colony. So you just fish that one out, and then you could analyze it. So just as a historical note, the very concept or the first analyses of gene regulation were done by Francois Jacob and Jacques Monod in the late 50s. And this was the example they started with. They got a lot of different lac minuses. They were able to use genetics to identify that there were two different genes involved. And then they studied how those genes were turned on and off in ways that I'm not sure I could really reproduce on the spot. But the basic point is they started, to answer your question, with something that had a different phenotype. So we call this the behavior of a phenotype. And as I said, there's lots of different ways of getting mutants, but in general, they're identified initially, usually, by having an altered phenotype, some kind of altered behavior that you can recognize. And so the process of genetics typically deals with isolating and analyzing the mutants in a lot of detail. So once you have a mutant, if it has a particular kind of behavior, then that gives you some information about what's going on in the cell. However, it's often very limited, because if you have a mutant that changes the behavior in some way, that could arise from a lot of different possible reasons. And so that's where having both genetics and biochemistry together comes in, because then you can use the biochemistry to help sort of weed out a lot of extraneous models that you might develop based on the genetics. And conversely, if the genetics and the biochemistry are consistent with each other, it gives you a lot more of a feeling that what you're doing, that you're thinking about the problem correctly, because it's always possible to do the biochemistry under conditions that are irrelevant to anything that's in the cell. It's always possible to do the genetics and to interpret complex behavior in ways that aren't really very mechanistically relevant to what's going on in the cell. Okay? So this ability to go back and forth between these two different approaches really makes a good, is important for any kind of good model organism, because it really lets you check your ideas, make them sharper, and then look at them back in the context of the whole cell. So the genetics is a kind of, let's say the biochemistry first, is a kind of divide and conquer philosophy. The idea is to take the components of the cell and break them, you know, separate them apart into one or just a few compounds, study their interactions with other components. The genetics, in a way, is sort of putting it all back together. It's more holistic or synthetic, I guess you could say. And so having both of these approaches really makes it possible, number one, to have a lot more confidence in your ideas, and number two, to make more rapid progress. So what I want to do now is to describe in a little bit of detail a particular gene regulatory circuit in our model organism, E. coli, that we've studied for a good while. And first, to tell you our current understanding of how this regulatory system works, and then to talk a little bit, going back to the initial question of how do biologists think, talk a little bit of how we figured this out. So the SOS system is a little bit more complicated than any examples I've given you. Instead of having one regulatory protein, it has two regulatory proteins. And these two proteins work together to give the observed behavior of this system. Let's start by saying that the goal of this system is not completely understood, But the overall goal of the regulatory system, insofar as we can presume to know what the goal for evolution, the selective pressures are, the goal is to help repair the DNA. So to say what that means, I think it's important to realize that I've talked about DNA as if it's totally fixed. We've already talked about the idea that it can change by mutation so that one of the nucleotides has a different one. But as a matter of fact, the DNA in any organism is constantly being damaged by various kinds of agents. So for example, if you go out in the sunlight without sunscreen on, some of the cells in your skin will get damaged. And the cell needs to be repaired. The DNA in the cell gets damaged, and the cell needs to repair that DNA so that it can still be used to do what its job is to carry and transmit that information. And so cells have a complicated set of mechanisms for repairing the DNA. I don't want to talk about that. There are just various ways that the DNA can be, that the damage can be reversed or cut out of the DNA to restore it to its original sequence. And I think when we think about the fact, it's important again now to talk about the fact that there's really two copies of the information in a particular set of DNA. So if this one gets damaged, you've got a template by which you can repair it. If they both get damaged, then you've got problems. In our cells, we've got another copy of the gene somewhere else in another chromosome, and in principle that could be used to repair it, but that's not the kind of issue I'm dealing with here. And so this cells have some capability of repairing the DNA just without involving this regulatory system, but if you have a substantial amount of DNA damage, then what happens is a set of genes, which we'll call the SOS genes, are turned on. So ordinarily these genes are expressed at a low level. If this SOS system is triggered, these genes get turned up fivefold, tenfold, twentyfold, fiftyfold. It differs compared depending on which gene we're talking about. So the goal of this system is to turn on a set of repair genes and other genes so that the cell can repair its DNA more efficiently.
Question.
Sure. Well, transcription doesn't damage the DNA generally, isn't not thought to. But for example, if there's a radiation from the sunlight, if you have two adjacent thymines, then they form a chemical adduct that links them together in such a way that they're no longer recognizable by the copying machinery to say, okay, I'm going to put an A in opposite this. The copying machinery comes up and says, what's this? And it has to be changed and put back to its original sequence before any copying machinery can act on it.
But it's when it's unzipped that this can happen.
It can happen either way, either time. And during the process of transcription, if I had a long DNA that went out through the wall out to the beach, even, the RNA polymerase would only be unwinding about 17 base pairs or so at any one time. And this unwound region is within the enzyme, so it's not, especially exposed to the environment.
There is a link between transcription and repair.
Sure.
At least in eukaryotic cells.
There is.
The more a gene is transcribed, usually the more efficiently it is repaired.
Okay. We can talk about that if you like. The idea in those cases, as I understand it, is if the gene's transcribed and it comes up to a site of damage, then the polymerase, I'm sorry, I put it on the wrong strand, if the polymerase comes up to this, it can't recognize it, it recruits some kind of repair machinery. So if the damage is in the strand that the RNA polymerase is copying, then it'll stop at that point and signal for a repair system to come and work on it. If the damage is in the other strand, then it, the RNA polymerase doesn't recognize it as damage and goes on by, and so it doesn't recruit the repair machinery in that case. So it's the bottom strand in this particular example that would be preferentially repaired.
Is there any redundancy in the way the protein is stored so that even if a part of it is damaged, it can be removed?
The DNA?
Yeah. So I mean, suppose there's one sequence which is coding for a protein.
Okay, well, I'll answer that really briefly now and get back to it in a minute. What part of the SOS system is involved in in the kind of situation that you're talking about, a sort of court of last resort. If there's no undamaged DNA, what do I do? And so Lewis will appreciate this more than most of you probably. We think of it as being a sort of better read than dead kind of situation where you have, okay, I'm gonna put in a mutation rather than just then give up. And so the process can be mutagenic if all the DNA, all the copies of the DNA are damaged. And I'll mention that briefly in a little bit. Okay, so let's talk about briefly this SOS system. I don't know, how long should we go on for? Okay. So in the SOS system, as I said, there are a bunch of genes called SOS genes. There's about 40 of them. I'm not going to draw them all. In fact, I'll just draw one to typify the whole set. And in an ordinary E. coli cell, and now I'm going to draw the DNA as a single line so we get more abstract as we go along. And this is meant to indicate a gene that can be expressed or not. Transcription unit, again, would be there. And in front of this, there's a binding site for a repressor protein called Lexa protein or Lexa repressor. So in ordinary growing E. coli, Lexa binds to there, and it prevents the RNA polymerase from binding to this site by, in most cases, just simple steric exclusion. If the DNA is damaged, the Lexa is changed in such a way that I'll describe in a minute, that it can no longer bind there, and now this gene will be transcribed. And so the intricacies of this system involve mostly the mechanism by which the Lexa is, its activity is modified. If there's DNA damage, then what happens is another protein in the cell, a second regulatory protein called RecA, is activated in a way I'll say in a second. So I want to first go through the pathway, and then I'll talk a little bit about more molecular details. The RecA is activated. Can you see it if I write down here? And when the RecA is activated, it mediates the cleavage. Let's just say it causes a specific cleavage reaction of Lexa. I'll say what that means in a second. And the Lexa is inactivated. So Lexa is not just a blob like I've drawn it there. A couple of years ago, we solved the structure of it. And it is known, it was really known before, to have two different domains. And if I'll just draw a piece of...
Lexa sits normally on the DNA.
That's right.
Anywhere or at the promoter or...
So it's a specific DNA binding protein.
Yes.
And it has a recognition site that lies partly overlapping the promoter. Okay.
So who recognizes that the DNA has been damaged? Lexa?
RecA. RecA does.
RecA.
Yeah, I'll talk more about the details in a minute, but I want to first sort of give you a sense of what this cleavage reaction is and why it, because actually what RecA does is complicated. I think it's interesting, but...
But RecA is not activated by Lexa, it's activated by...
By DNA damage, that's right, yeah. I'll get to the details of how that works in a second. Lexa is organized in, again, very schematically, into a DNA binding domain. So this is one of these proteins that has what we call a modular domain structure. That is to say, one part of it folds up into a discrete functional structural unit, another part folds up into a different structural unit. This part here is involved in forming what we call a dimer. That's to say, a molecule that has two subunits of Lexa, and there's an axis, a pseudo-dyad axis of symmetry here that relates this subunit to that subunit. The sequence of the DNA also has a lot of dyad symmetry. So for the Lexa to bind tightly to this region, it has to form a dimer. The cleavage reaction that inactivates Lexa here cuts the Lexa at a place in between the dimerization domain and the DNA binding domain, so that the DNA binding domain is no longer able to dimerize, and in consequence, it binds much, much more weakly to the DNA. So that's why cleavage of Lexa inactivates it. And when the Lexa is inactivated, then the SOS genes are now able to be expressed at high levels because the Lexa is no longer able to bind here to turn them off. Okay, so looking at this from the point, I guess you'd call it control theory, Lexa is acting as a negative regulator of these genes because as long as it's present and active, it's turning them off. Rec-A is acting as a positive activator of these genes because when it's present in this activated form, the genes turn on. However, note, I talked before about activators, ones that would bind to the DNA somewhere and turn the gene on directly. This one's working by an indirect mechanism by antagonizing a negative effector.
I have a question. I'm just curious. Now, we're given to understand that DNA, there's a lot of junk region. If the junk part also gets damaged, is there some kind of repair machinery?
So
we also try to repair the junk as well.
Yeah. Because the machinery that repairs it and that copies it, that can't tell the difference between junk and the real deal. Okay?
Okay, the damage prevents duplication. Mm-hmm. You have to repair
it. So let's talk about how the Rec-A gets activated. The current thinking about this, and this is a difficult problem for reasons I'll say in a minute, but the current thinking is, as you said, if you have damage in one strand of the DNA, this is something I haven't talked about really, but I think it's important to bear in mind that the DNA has, as I said, a redundant information. When the DNA is replicated, let's just simplify that process a lot, what happens basically is that the two strands are pulled apart and a copy is made of each strand. So we'd make a new copy here using this as a template, would put in TTACG. Same thing here. And so now we'd have two copies instead of one. Okay, so this is the process of what we call DNA replication. It's actual making two copies for one. And it really depends on the redundancy in the information to allow two new copies to be made. So backing up a little bit now, if we look at how this is copied, in fact, you don't just pull the whole DNA apart and then make a copy. What happens is some kind of machine, which again I'll simplify a lot, moves down the DNA, making copies of it. And I'm just going to really simplify this and say that it moves down the machine in that, down the DNA in this direction, making two copies for one. So one copy goes into the machine, two copies come out. It's a lot more complicated than this, but this will do. Now let's imagine what happens when it reaches the site of damage. Now the one that's copying this strand still has a good template here, but the one that's copying the bottom strand, if it hits a pyrimidine dimer, doesn't know what to do, and so it stops. And so the thinking is, and it's not clear.
How do you know which is the damaged one and which is not the
damaged one? What we've got here is a really complicated machine. I don't know how many, 10 different proteins or something like that. And its job is to make a copy of this strand. And in a somewhat separate process to make a copy of this strand. So it doesn't matter which strand has the damage in a sense, it still has to be copied, and no matter which strand it's in, if it can't be recognized as one of the four normal bases, it can't be copied. So it has to wait until that's repaired. Or it can do the repair in more indirect ways that I'll probably not take the time to.
You don't consider it as a damage.
No, if it was a mutation that changed a C to a G, the machinery wouldn't know. Because the way you tell if it's a mutation is by this process, by having an aberrant protein. And that's not the job of this, is to copy whatever is there. And if it's damaged, it stops. And so this is the part that's not totally well understood, but evidence from mostly from biochemical studies suggests that if the replication fork comes up to the site of damage, that it generates a region of single-stranded DNA where only one of the strands is present in that region. And in that situation, then, the RecA protein is thought to bind to the single-stranded DNA, and that's the activated form of RecA. So it's binding, it's activated by binding to something that's not ordinarily present in the cell in substantial amounts. What we study in my lab is actually how the activated RecA causes this cleavage event, and I'll just say this really briefly, and I'm happy to talk to anybody about it in more detail, is that RecA doesn't act itself to catalyze this cleavage reaction. Well, it catalyzes it, but it doesn't act like a normal enzyme, like a protease. Somehow, it tweaks the Lexa to cause the Lexa to cut itself in half. So the Lexa has a built-in sort of self-destruct module, and RecA, in some way that we'd like to understand, can trigger that. Okay?
If you just introduce single-strand DNA, would you activate SOS mechanism as well?
There's been a few experiments along those lines. It's actually as hard to do, partly because the DNA, single-stranded DNA, tends to get degraded from the ends by the enzymes in the cell. It's just hard to get a lot of single-stranded DNA into the cell.
If the RecA is activated by being bound to single-stranded DNA, you seem to be postulating that it's then able to get off the single-stranded DNA, retain its activated state, and go act on RecA. So what's happening there? How does it remember?
Oh, there's no, I'm sorry. There's no reason to think it needs to dissociate for the, oh, I'm sorry. So some of the Lexa, so this goes, that's a good question. So the one important point about specific DNA binding proteins that I forgot to mention is that their interaction with the DNA is freely reversible. And so if we have some molecules of Lexa bound here, at any one time, there'll be a certain number of molecules free in solution. And it's thought that those are the ones that are attacked by the activated RecA. Okay? Another part of what you were getting at is that this activation isn't forever. And there's good reasons that this is the case. The cell needs to get about its business. So if the DNA is repaired, the signal goes away, and the cells return to a normal growth state. So if the DNA is repaired, then the fork now can move through. As the RecA dissociates, the fork can now copy this single-stranded DNA, and there's no longer a signal to activate the RecA. Okay? So that's basically, in a simplified version, our current understanding of how the SOS system works.
Is it known what percentage of the energy budget of a cell is spent on repairing this?
I would guess it's pretty small percentage. It depends on how huge an amount of damage there is, of course. But repairing this is not a really expensive process.
Uh-huh.
Is there a biochemical understanding of the sort of the basic mutational events that can happen in normal?
You mean how these?
Yeah.
Well, so this is a bit of DNA damage. Yeah, this is not a mutation yet. It's called it's called a pre-mutagenic lesion. And I'm sorry, that was the other thing I was going to say here, is that if this damage is severe and long-lasting, then one of the SOS genes that's made, that's turned on kind of late in the game, is something that can take this damage and say, geez, I give up, and just put any old thing in there, and then the cell goes about its business. Or there's some specificity for what's put in there. But it's put something in, like I said, better red than dead. It's going to be able to make some kind of copy if there are a lot of places in the DNA where putting in an A or something that's not supposed to be there, that it's innocuous, and so there's at least a chance that you're going to not be damaged too severely. But it's thought this is one of the important kinds of mutagenic processes that leads to changes in the cell.
So the SOS gene, the proteins, excise the database?
Some of them do, yeah. Well, they work by various mechanisms. One is an excision repair that takes it out and uses the other strand as a copy. A little hard to do in this case, but there are ways for it to back up, so it can happen. Another is recombinational repair, where it uses a different copy of the DNA in the cell to get a source of undamaged information, essentially. And then there's this error-prone mechanism I talked about before. Did I see another hand? Yes, here you go.
If this T breach is so damaging, is there a selective pressure, can one observe a selective pressure in the genome to remove this T next to, stay next to T whenever it's possible?
Well, it also can happen with a C next to a T and a T next to a C and a C next to a C. So that's a pretty big constraint.
The dominant form somehow.
Sorry?
Is the most dangerous form?
No, I think it's the most common form that happens when you UV it, but that's by no means the only one.
There is a non-random distribution of TT pairs inside the most genomes.
I see.
Oh, really?
And especially in the junk part, it should be easy to remove.
There is what's called CPG islands, where you have a lot of, I mean, it's not TT in this particular case, but where you have high CG concentration for CG pairs following, not facing each other, but following each other. This is particularly prone to certain sort of damage, and the genome prior tends to avoid these sort of things or concentrate them in certain areas.
Mm-hmm. Is there a critical threshold? You seem to hint at that. Is the damage I introduce so much damage at some point in the machine you just say, I give up? Is there such a thing, or just keep on?
Well, they never give up. I mean, they might die in the process. But
so what does it mean when the cell would die? It just stop functioning?
It doesn't give any progeny.
So the
operationally
processes will still go on
for a little while at least, yeah, but it's not able to make two good copies of DNA to give to two descendant cells, and in fact it's not even able to make one good copy of DNA to try again later.
Is there enough understanding of the repair mechanism to account for the total mutation rate?
I guess people have tried to model it. I don't know, I'm not familiar with those studies. I mean, part of what complicates it is there's always damage going on in our cells all the time, just oxidation. There's a lot of oxygen around, and the oxygen creates molecules that can damage the DNA directly, and then those need to be repaired all the time as well. So there's no way of getting rid of all sources of damage, even if you get rid of cosmic rays. So.
You want to live a long time, James?
No, I just asked. I mean,
don't breathe.
50 years ago. The ability of lowering the mutation rate to 10 to the minus whatever it has to be, 4 or something like that, it was regarded as nigh impossible. In fact, there were physicists who wrote papers saying life had to be used new laws of physics and chemistry because you couldn't do it. Is it still a mystery or is it understood?
As far as I know, there is no such thing as an average rate of mutation that you could apply to a whole genome. There are mutational hotspots. I mean, if you look at the rate of mutations along the genome, you see these huge peaks at certain places, and no one has really any clear idea why they exist.
So that would mean in other places it's even smaller.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So another.
It's still miraculous. I mean,
well, another way to answer.
This one that I believe it's
more. No, I don't mean.
Well, so, but.
I feel understood.
But I mean, one thing to say in answer to what you were saying about these calculations is there are actually several sequential repair pathways that operate. First, there's the choice of which nucleotide to put in, and some rate in the error you cited 10 to the minus 4th or so operates there. Then there's a second mechanism called proofreading that checks it once it's put in to say, is this all right or is it wrong? If it's wrong, it chops it out, and that has another error rate of 10 to the minus 4th.
How does it
proofread? It looks after the nucleotide's incorporated, it looks the enzyme that's putting it in, it puts it in, and then it looks at it to see if it's paired with the template strand. And if it's not, it has an activity that chops it out. And then there's something called mismatch repair that can operate after that. So if a mistake was made here, I put a T opposite a G, bacteria at least have the capability of telling which is the new strand versus the old one, and it corrects the new strand to the old one if it recognizes a mismatch.
What are the most common causes of mutation?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure. So what I wanted to do, and it looks like we're running out of time, so I'll try to do it really briefly, is to ask a question, well, how do we know this? So this goes back to the topic, the title that Boris chose for me, which is, how do we think? How do molecular biologists think? And I guess I could give a relatively brief answer in this particular case, is that this model, which I've drawn, is derived as a result of a large number of experimental observations and experimental tests of an idea. But we can kind of, and it'd be hard to describe the process by which this model arose, so we can kind of, I don't know if you'd call it reverse engineering, but we can take this model and, I mean, a lot of the thought process that comes into making a model like this, you can understand by saying, let's take this model and see what it predicts, okay? So let's just think about that for a minute. What would happen to this system? Let's just simplify life again and say that we can observe all the states of this system. We can say if there's minus damage or plus damage, we can tell if the system is on or off. So the wild type is like this. A mutant that's always on would be like that. A mutant that's always off would be like that. Okay, just to, again, make a binary table out of it. So what would we expect if we knocked out Lex-A? What does this model predict?
Always on.
Always on. So Lex-A knockout would be like that. What about if we knocked out Rec-A? So that would be a Rec-A knockout. What if we knocked out both of them?
Always on.
Okay, good. So that would be the Lex-A Rec-A double. What if we made the Lex-A resistant to cleavage? So that we would call, that would be always off because there's no way of turning it on. We call that a Lex-A non-inducible. What if we had a Rec-A that was always active? It's possible to do because you could just change the Rec-A specificity so it would bind to stuff that's ordinarily present in the cell. How would that work in this system?
Always on.
So let's just, all, this is getting crowded. I'll call that a Rec-A. Let's just call it S for super. What if we put the Rec-A that's always on together with a Lex-A that can't be cleaved?
Always off.
So that's right. Okay, so that'd be a Rec-A super Lex-A non-cleavable. That double mute. So when a model like this is developed, it's, you can think of a lot of different kind of models. If this information's available, you can test any of those models in a very straightforward way, like I just talked about, against any model that you're thinking up that you want to test. If it doesn't fit this pattern, then you say, whoop, back to the drawing board.
Does it?
Yes.
when you say fit or not, the data is not clean, there's some statistics. So what is it taking to decide whether it agrees or doesn't agree?
Well, the difference in... Oh, well, I'll tell you how we decide, and you can tell me, you can put it in physicist terms. If we have a gene that's expressed, that's derepressed, say, 20-fold, and we see that it's 5%, it's fully its maximum rate, then we'd say it's always off. For a rare gene that's, if we have a different mutant that's close to 100%, those numbers are going to bounce around, but they're not going to, there's not going to be a sort of a continuous distribution between 5 and 100%. So I'm,
Always.
Well, if you, almost always. If you, I mean, you can imagine complicated situations where it would be more, where you would get an intermediate result. So let me just mention this as an example of what this, so let's notice, you've actually done, by answering my questions, thought about this the way a geneticist thinks about it. One of the things that we always try to do when we, so we've got here a pathway that has two components. In principle, they could work together, but also they might work in sequentially, in which case one would be what we might call downstream of the other one. And at least for regulatory systems, if you put two mutations together that have opposite effects, like this one turns it on all the time, this one turns it off all the time, if you put two together that have opposite effects, then the downstream one is the one that determines what the behavior of the system is. In this case, the downstream one is LexA in the pathway that I diagrammed. So both double mutant combinations that we talked about, this one and that one, are both consistent with this ordering of the pathway. Let me just say one more thing, and that is that these tests I've given you are all genetics tests. Now, we could say, what are the biochemical properties of all these? As a practical matter, what was done to investigate the biochemical properties was to purify these two proteins and study their behavior in the test tube. So, for example, we found that LexA, in fact, does bind to sites in front of the genes it regulates. We found that if we mix activated RecA with LexA, the LexA is cut in half, and so forth. So all the biochemical experiments that people have done are consistent with this model as well. And that's where the idea about RecA being activated by single-stranded DNA came from, because you need to add single-stranded DNA to the cell.
Does one go generically about purifying the protein with the
orange? Oh, okay, that's an advancing a set of techniques. The modern way to do it, if you're lucky and it works, is to put some kind of handle on the protein, like a his tag is an example of it, or GST, or there's a lot of different versions of this idea. Let's just say, if you put a run of six histidines on the end, either end of your protein, then that protein will bind to a column that has nickel on it, for example.
But first of all, you have to localize the gene for that protein.
Yeah, that's right.
Because if you just know it, just on the level of genetics, that there is a mutation which affects the phenotype. So
yeah, then you have to
first locate
the gene.
Well,
again, that depends on the situation, but ideal, I mean, one way to do it would be to take all the genes from the cell in a random kind of way, put them in, and see which ones restore the normal behavior. And that would identify the gene to you. But you don't have to do any of this stuff if you have an assay. If you have an assay for your protein, you can use a standard set of techniques to isolate that protein away from everything else in the cell. And we could talk about how you do that, but it's...
How many people hours did it take for you to figure this out? I mean, I'll have some idea.
People hours, you said?
Years.
Well, let's see. I worked on this model for 4 years, I guess. My contribution was mostly to isolate LexA.
So how many other groups are working?
At the same time, we're doing this, so three or four others, I guess. And so it's a lot of work.
And each group is, I mean, how many people in your group?
I was working by myself part of the time, and there were, you know, two or three other people for part of the time. But yeah, it's a big undertaking. It's easier now to do it. So I mean, one thing that makes it a lot easier is most of the genomes we're interested in are sequenced, and so you can have at least a reasonable idea that you could go to the sequence if you have a phenotype, you can go to a pool of things and bring them in and say which one's, I mean, so there's lots of ways of short-circuiting it based on advances in
presumably
methodology.
Presumably it's wild because something you haven't said, which is true, that this a mechanism like this should work in almost every organism.
Well, I don't know if it would work in eukaryotes. I don't know of any evidence that it does, actually. But in principle, something, I mean, you might have to change the mechanisms, the specific details of the mechanism, say, by which the recce is activated. But that's okay. And then it might work in other organisms as well, yeah. There's no evidence that it happens in other, I mean, they're the general goal, like I said, of this is
the gene is sequence.
This gene's not found in eukaryotes. There's a gene similar to this that's found in eukaryotes, but it doesn't seem to have this regulatory property. Just to complicate life a little bit, this RecA protein has a whole other property that the cell uses it to patch, to do what's called genetic recombination. That's where the name came from, in which you have, let's say, one piece of DNA, a second piece of DNA that's distinct in some way, genetically distinct, and the RecA, at least at an informational level, can catalyze making a molecule that has the information from this up to some point, and then suddenly it's changed. And it's extremely elaborate how it does that. I don't want to try to describe that now. That, as a matter of fact, complicated life for people figuring this out, because a lot of the early manifestations of this regulatory system were seen in mutants that affected RecA, and everybody said, gee, how can we, because everybody thought of RecA not as a regulatory protein like I'm describing it here, but instead as something that did this recombination reaction. And so whenever you find something that the RecA mutants are doing wrong or that they're defective in, you'd say, gee, how can I relate that to recombination? And in fact, a lot of it wasn't related to recombination, but to a defect in turning on this pathway.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay.